Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the Arizona Republic, what type of mulch is best? Four options, broken down by geographic region, by Paul Capiello. It's always best to know why you're doing something before you decide how to do it. Without knowing why you're mulching, it's hard to know how to properly mulch. Effective mulch can be just about any loose aggregate material that will stay where it's put, not significantly reduce air exchange into and out of the soil, and not contribute anything toxic to the soil or root environment. A proper mulch material can help to reduce evaporative water loss and reduce heat buildup in the soil during long, hot summers. It can help improve rain percolation into the soil, decrease weed pressure in the garden, and some mulches can also add nutrients to the soil below. Of course, that is assuming you've selected the right mulch for your location and that you've applied it in a sensible way. So let's take a regional look to see what works best where. Northeast region, hardwood bark, composted. In this part of the country, the most common mulch material is probably hardwood bark. Most of it is a byproduct of the timber, lumber, paper industries. It's generally ground to a relatively uniform particle size and spread fairly easily with a rake or mulch fork. One of the most important things to consider when looking to use hardwood bark mulch is whether or not your source is composted hardwood bark. Uncomposted hardwood bark has a tendency to form an impenetrable crust when it gets hot and dry in summer. That means in a summer thunderstorm or your irrigation attempt, it will send all that water sheeting off the mulch and down the storm drain while your plants suffer from drought conditions. Composted bark also supplies more net nutrient gain to the soil below and holds in place better during a heavy rain event. Southeast region, it's all about the pine. Here, there are two winters. Pine straw is generally harvested from agroforestry operations where the needles are simply collected as they naturally fall from the branches. It is lightweight, easy to spread, and holds in place quite nicely. Pine straw allows rain and irrigation to pass freely into the soil and provides for excellent air exchange between above and below the mulch layer. Pine straw also has an added advantage of discouraging slugs, a major plus if you have any hostas in your garden. The biggest challenge with pine straw is that it's difficult to keep clean. If you have big old hollies that drop old yellowed leaves in early summer, a normal thing for hollies, those big long pine needles love to intertwine themselves among the holly spines. Trying to rake the leaves out of the mulch can be infuriating. The second winter in the southeast is what we call pine fines. This used to be a waste product from the manufacture of those giant silly pine nuggets you sometimes still see for sale as mulch. These giant nuggets provide almost no mulch benefit. They float away in the slightest bit of rain runoff. As kids, we used to file them into boat shapes and race them down the neighborhood creek. Also, they provide almost no weed suppression, and they break down so slowly that they add little organic matter or nutrition to the soil. Pine fines, on the other hand, have particles less than 1/2 inch across. The product spreads nicely, looks fabulous, breaks down at a reasonable rate, and adds a nice bit of organic matter and nutrition to the soil. Pine fines, however, are not a great product for a garden bed that sits on any kind of slope. A heavy rain can send your pine fines down the driveway and into the street. For moderate to steep slopes, pine straw works better. Northwest region, softwood bark is best. In this region, you'll see quite a bit of what we call softwood bark mulch. Mostly consisting of processed bark from hemlock and Douglas fir, this mulch is similar to the southeast's pine fines, just maybe not quite as small in particle size. As with hardwood bark mulch, it's best to find a source that is composted, and if formal composting isn't an option, an old pile that's been sitting around a while is still better than fresh. The larger and sometimes stringier texture compared to pine fines means the Northwest softwood bark mulch will hold up a little better on a moderate slope. Southwest region, yes, stones are mulches too. Rounding out the regions, we'll cover an inorganic mulch, stone. While stone mulches are not the only types used in the drier portions of the Southwest, they are more common than in other parts of the lower 48. One reason stone mulches work well in the Southwest, and they work perfectly well in other parts of the country too, is that the extreme heat of this region would cause most organic mulches to break down to nothing in no time. One last note, regardless of mulch of choice, please, no mulch volcanoes around the base of trees, and no more than 2 inches of mulch on any bed. From the Wall Street Journal, how your Mother's Day orchid became a mass-market commodity. Once a rare luxury for the wealthy, orchids can now be had for $10 at the grocery store, by Joe Craven McGinty. Orchids have long been coveted for the beauty of their blooms, but until recently, the exotic plants were a hard-to-grow luxury that few could afford. Now, the one-time symbols of wealth sell for as little as $10 in supermarkets and big-box stores. They are the top-selling potted plant in America, and the single biggest day for sales is Mother's Day. The secret to their success? Cloning. Botanists can propagate orchids from seed, but they take years to flower, and no two plants look exactly alike. To succeed in the mass market, growers must supply plants of identical quality, the same height, colors, and impressive arrays of blossoms in bulk and fast. By cloning, if you get 10,000 plants, the quality of the 10,000 plants will be the same, said Yao Chin Alex Chang, an orchid expert and chair of the Department of Horticulture and Landscape Architecture at National Taiwan University in Taipei. In addition, cloned orchids mature and flower in 12 to 18 months, compared with 3 or more years for plants started from seed. The return on investment is apparent. In 2023, Americans spent $256 million wholesale on potted orchids, more than any other potted plant. Poinsettias, the favorite until orchids surpassed them in 2009, had just $167 million in sales in the same period. Measured in pots, orchids exceeded 34 million units. Two of the world's largest orchid growers are Matsui Nursery in Salinas, California, and Tasuco America in Aromas, California, a subsidiary of Taiwan Sugar Corp. Matsui Nursery sells 2.3 million orchids annually, with Mother's Day accounting for 14% of its sales, according to Teresa Matsui, the company's president and chief executive. Tasuco America sells as many as 2 million plants annually, with Mother's Day accounting for 11 to 15%, according to Richard Munoz, the company's operations manager and safety director. Together, they will ship around 500,000 plants for the holiday. Being able to stock the shelves of Trader Joe's, Home Depot, and other outlets annually with tens of millions of orchids took a century of innovation, despite the plant's extraordinary diversity and range. There are as many 30,000 native species and at least 150,000 man-made hybrids. They're found on every continent of the world, except Antarctica, and in every environment from deserts to tropical rainforests. No other flowering plant comes close in terms of species diversity or geographic range. And yet, early botanists struggled to grow these surprisingly adaptable flowers. To begin with, they didn't understand how to germinate the plants. In the wild, orchids sprout from seeds, but these seeds offer a host of challenges. They are the smallest of any plant in the world, and unlike beans or other seeds whose fleshy tissue nourishes an embryo, orchid seeds hold nothing in reserve to feed their offspring. They are dust-like, said Mark Hakkadorian, senior curator of orchids at the New York Botanical Garden. They make a poppy seed look like a coconut. So how, botanists wondered, was an orchid embryo nourished? Near the turn of the last century, a French botanist figured out that fungi provide orchids and their seeds with the nourishment they need, and 2 decades later, a botanist at Cornell University devised a way to germinate the seeds in the laboratory by replacing fungus with a nutrient-rich gel. While significant, these advances weren't enough to catapult the orchid to ubiquity. That began to change in the 1980s, when Taiwan Sugar, or TSC, played a pivotal role in popularizing the plant. Having been priced out of the sugar market, state-owned TSC began looking for a new moneymaker. It settled on orchids and invested heavily in tissue culture techniques, a method of propagation also known as cloning. Phalaenopsis, the moth orchid that is prevalent in markets and big box stores today, became the primary focus of TSC's agribusiness division. Several people showed how to tissue culture Phalaenopsis, but they didn't get a lot of plants, said Rob Greisbach, a plant geneticist who worked at the agriculture department at the time and is credited with developing the Toyland orchid, an easy-to-grow miniature. In Taiwan, they discovered a process that could produce lots of plants. Instead of hundreds, they could get hundreds of thousands. Commercially grown Phalaenopsis are typically cloned by snipping segments from a plant stalk where a node with a dormant bud is located. One stalk might have multiple nodes, and each can be propagated into a flowering plant that is genetically identical to its parent. You can make this one plant into three, National Taiwan University's Chang said. After this, maybe 2 months, you would do it again. Your three plants will get 9, and then again you will get 27. Theoretically, a million clones could descend from a single gorgeous orchid. But because mutations become increasingly likely with each generation of clones, most growers choose not to propagate that many plants from one parent. Learning to reliably produce high-quality plants rapidly and in bulk was a major advance, but getting them to market was just as important. Today, most potted orchids sold in the United States are propagated abroad, with the largest number coming from Taiwan. The challenge is shipping. Cloning provides an advantage for that as well by allowing growers to pack maximum numbers of identically sized plants into uniform packing boxes, a cost-saving efficiency. Earlier varieties were mostly seed production plants, Taisuko's Munoz said. Though very unique in size and color, shipping them was quite the challenge. 60 to 100 potted clones, depending on how mature they are, fit into one ventilated cardboard box, and 520 to 600 boxes can be loaded into a 40-foot climate-controlled shipping container for a voyage that will last about 18 days if the destination is California. U.S. companies continue to grow the plants until they're ready for the market. In as little as 4 to 6 months, Phalaenopsis orchids can be on their way to retail markets across the country in full bloom. It's too good to be true, Greisbach said. I'm buying them for under $10, and they'll last for 3 months. From BetterHomesAndGardens.com, 18 long-living perennials that will last for decades with little care. These perennials can live for many years without needing much maintenance from you, by Cheryl Geertz. Plant perennials, and they'll generally come back year after year, instead of needing replanting like annuals do. But not all perennials are alike. Some will bloom beautifully for a few seasons, and then slowly decline unless you intervene, while others have some serious staying power, lasting for decades without needing much care from you. Here's a roundup of the longest-lasting perennial varieties to try in your garden. Peony is first on the list. If you want to leave a flowering legacy, plant peonies. These hardy perennials will last for decades. In fact, peonies that were planted in the Better Homes and Gardens test garden in the 1950s are still vibrantly blooming today. Add grid stakes around your peonies to provide support when the plants are blooming to keep the flowers from toppling over. Growing conditions, full sun to part shade and well-drained soil. Size, 1 to 3 feet tall and 2 to 3 feet wide. And peonies grow in zones 3 through 8. Liriope number 2, also called lily turf, liriope has narrow, grass-like foliage that can be green or variegated. It's an excellent ground cover or edging plant that is often planted to control erosion on steep slopes. This problem-solving perennial can't persist for years. In fact, it has been found growing in long-abandoned southern gardens. Growing conditions for liriope, full sun to part shade and well-drained soil, grows 12 to 24 inches tall and wide, and it grows in zones 5 through 10. And a warning, liriope is considered invasive in some areas of the country. Daylilies, third on the list. As tough as they are long-lived, daylilies are rugged enough to grow and bloom in commercial landscapes along highways and steep hillsides. Available in a seemingly endless assortment of colors, bicolors, and flower forms, daylilies will persist for years in your garden. They need to be divided every few years to keep them blooming, but the plants will remain alive even if you ignore them. Growing conditions, full sun to part shade and well-drained soil, grows 1 to 3 feet tall and wide, and daylilies grows in zones 3 through 10. Hosta, number 4. Year after year, you can rely on Hostas to brighten shady corners of your landscape. Varieties for your shade garden are available in numerous colors, sizes, leaf shapes, and textures. Their only enemies are snails, slugs, and deer, so if you can keep those pests at bay, you'll be able to enjoy Hostas long after you plant them. Growing conditions, part to full shade and well-drained soil. Size 6 to 48 inches tall and 1 to 8 feet wide. And Hostas grows in zones 3 through 8. Number 5 is Iris. The Iris family boasts a large number of long-lived relatives. Bearded Iris, shown here in this photograph, can often be found blooming around abandoned houses or in historic cemeteries. Siberian and African irises are two other species that will persist in your garden with little attention from you. All irises, including those that rebloom, need to be divided every few years to promote flowering, but they'll live on even without the extra attention. Growing conditions, full sun and well-drained soil, size 6 to 40 inches tall and 6 to 30 inches wide, and irises grow in zones 3 through 10 for bearded, 3 through 8 for Siberian, 9 to 11 for African. Next, number 6 is Oriental Poppy. After seeing its crepe paper-like blooms, you might think that Oriental Poppy is a delicate plant, but this power perennial will thrive despite the toughest conditions. In fact, it's been found growing around long-neglected farmsteads. Native to Central Asia, Oriental Poppies survive summer drought by going dormant after they flower in the spring and then reappear in the early fall. Once poppies are established in the garden, it's best not to move them. However, poppies can be divided and transplanted in the fall if necessary. Growing conditions, full sun and well-drained soil, grows 2 to 4 feet tall and 12 to 24 inches wide, and Oriental Poppy grows well in zones 3 through 7. Baptisia, number 7. Commonly called false indigo, Baptisia is a native prairie plant that's been given a modern makeover with a number of new color options. These tall, mounding perennials develop gorgeous spikes of pea-like flowers and blue-green foliage that's pretty enough to stand on its own. Because it's naturally drought and insect-resistant, Baptisia will last for decades in your garden. It's relatively slow-growing, so buy the largest plant you can find to enjoy its flowers as soon as possible. Growing conditions for Baptisia, full sun to part shade and well-drained soil. Grows 2 to 4 feet tall and wide, and grows in zones 3 through 9. Number 8 on the list is sedum. Drought-tolerant and almost foolproof, sedums return year after year. There are many species of sedum to choose from, but some of the best sedums are the ground cover varieties, such as dragon's blood. These beautiful rock garden plants will slowly carpet your garden with color even under extreme weather conditions. Growing conditions, full sun and well-drained soil, size 2 to 36 inches tall and 14 to 48 inches wide, and sedum grows in zones 4 through 9. Catmint is next. Pollinators can't seem to get enough of catmint. Add these fuss-free plants to sunny beds and borders, where they'll develop wands of pretty blue or white nectar-rich flowers from late spring into summer. Growing conditions, full sun to part shade and well-drained soil. Grows 6 to 12 inches tall and 12 to 36 inches wide, and catmint grows zones 4 through 8. New England aster. A native wildflower, New England aster is a top choice for providing late-season color for your garden. This bold perennial is literally smothered in pink or purplish-blue flowers from late summer into fall. Growing conditions, full sun and well-drained soil. Grows 3 to 6 feet tall and 2 to 3 feet wide, and grows in zones 4 through 8. Next on the list is Agapanthus. A super reliable and long-lived perennial in warm climate areas, Agapanthus produces tall flower stalks with colorful balls of white or blue trumpet-shaped flowers that make a great fresh-cut flower. Growing conditions, full sun to part shade, grows 1 to 4 feet tall and 1 to 3 feet wide, and Agapanthus grows in zones 6 through 10. Wisteria, number 12. Often blooming for generations, wisteria vines offer trailing purple or white fragrant spring flowers. A vigorous climber, wisteria requires strong support because as the vine matures, it can become heavy enough to collapse lightweight arbors or trellises. Growing conditions, full sun and well-drained soil, grows 10 to 25 feet tall and wide, and wisteria grows in zones 3 through 9. Next on the list is trumpet vine. Hummingbirds will flock to your garden if you've got a trumpet vine in bloom. This vigorous native plant will quickly scramble up and over trellises, fences, and arbors, producing quantities of trumpet-shaped crimson, yellow, or orange flowers all summer long. Growing conditions, full sun to part shade and average soil, grows 20 to 40 feet tall and 5 to 20 feet wide, and trumpet vine grows in zones 4 through 9. Heliopsis, often called false sunflower or oxeye daisy. Heliopsis is a native wildflower that develops wave after wave of cheerful yellow blooms in mid to late summer. Growing conditions, full sun and well-drained soil. Grows 2 to 5 feet tall and 1 to 3 feet wide. And Heliopsis grows in zones 3 through 9. Moss phlox, number 15, one of the shortest members of the phlox family, moss phlox puts on a big spring flower show year after year. Covered in blue, pink, white, or violet blooms, this low-growing plant makes excellent ground cover for small slopes or rock gardens. Growing conditions, full sun and well-drained soil, grows 6 inches tall and 2 to 3 feet wide, and grows in zones 3 through 9. Number 16 is yarrow. Yarrow doesn't mind drought or poor soil. It produces flat flower heads above lacy foliage in mid to late summer. Growing conditions, full sun and well-drained soil. Grows 6 to 24 inches tall and 2 to 3 feet wide, and yarrow is grown in zones 3 through 9. Astilbe, number 17. Astilbe is a bit of a show-off, producing both striking spikes of feathery flowers and pretty fern-like foliage. The flowers, which come in pink, white, red, and purple, bloom in summer, while the mounds of bronze-tinged green foliage look good and stay compact year-round. Growing conditions for Astilbe: full sun to part shade and moist, well-drained soil. Grows 1 to 3 feet tall and 18 to 30 inches wide, and grows in zones 4 through 8. Finally, number 18 is salvia. Perennial salvia is the kind of plant that will boost your garden confidence. With very little fuss and not a ton of water once it's established, this drought-tolerant and deer-resistant perennial grows quickly and pumps out spikes of flowers for years. Growing conditions, full sun to part shade and well-drained soil. Grows 1 to 3 feet tall and wide, and salvia grows in zones 3 through 10. And those of you who listen to this show on a regular basis know we feature stories from the terrific book called Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called The Man Who Lived in a Box. It was written by Marsha E. Brown, and there's a quote here from Jimmy Johnson. Treat a person as he is, and he will remain as he is. Treat him as he could be, and he will become what he should be. The Man Who Lived in a Box. Macduff was his name, Tom Macduff, though I never heard him called by his first name. My mother met him at the day labor pickup corner down on 3rd Street near the river. He was the leanest, saddest, hungriest looking of the men standing there, anxiously watching as she slowed her car and parked. Macduff was not the first man to approach mother's car, where she sat looking over the small crowd. He simply was not able to move that quickly. But when she called out that she needed a man to dig gardens for several mornings only, the others fell back. They wanted full days of work. Macduff then came forward. He doffed his weather-stained felt hat and stood holding it nervously in his hands. When he spoke, his voice was low and he coughed between sentences. "I can dig, ma'am," he told her. "I dug lots of foxholes and trenches in the war." "Do you know anything about gardening?" mother asked. "Not yet, ma'am," he answered, with a slight crinkle at the corners of his eyes. Well, that hit of humor and willingness to learn touched my mother, along with the sad condition of the old army coat and broken boots Macduff wore that chilly autumn morning. "I'm the city landscaper with a tiny budget. I can pay you only minimum wages," she cautioned him. He accepted, adding that he had recently been in a veterans hospital with pneumonia and was not yet able to work a full day. As Mother drove them toward the new park, she wondered if her new worker would be strong enough for even a full morning's work. When they passed a bakery perfuming the morning air with the smell of freshly baked bread, Macduff inhaled deeply. "Have you had any breakfast?" Mother asked. "No, ma'am," came the shy, quiet response. Mother pulled abruptly to the curb, got out and went into the bakery, returning with a bag of donuts and two containers of coffee. "I'll have mine later. You eat now," she told her passenger. "Much obliged, ma'am." She pretended not to see tears spring to the man's eyes as he tore into a donut, almost swallowing it whole. That was the start of a working partnership and loyal friendship that would last for 20 years. When Macduff failed to show up for work later that week, my mother went looking for him. Another laborer told her to check down by the river. She was shocked to find that Macduff and a dozen other homeless men were living in boxes under a bridge over the Arkansas River. Adrift since separation from the Army at the end of World War II, they were in poor health and untrained for available work. Local police tolerated the shack community as long as there was no trouble. Few knew of its hidden existence. When the weather grew cold, some of the men would disturb the peace enough to get themselves thrown into a warm jail. There were no town shelters for such unfortunate people. Mother didn't have a big budget, but she had a big heart. She scrounged up more funds, and Macduff's first days planting bulbs were soon extended to full-time employment. Many long days, he and my mother worked side by side. It was not easy for either. Mother was a small woman with back problems that were a forerunner to osteoporosis, but she had a mental backbone second to none. For a long time, Macduff did not really have the strength for a full day of arduous work, and he suffered from frequent colds. He missed quite a few days of work, and several times Mother saved his life by rushing him to the hospital when pneumonia struck again. She was patient with Macduff's absences, and his progress was steady. Day by day, chore by chore, she taught him horticulture. Macduff was an eager student. Day by day, too, as his life stabilized, his strength improved. When spring came and those daffodils bloomed and were admired by visitors, Macduff was as proud of them as Mother was. Over the years, Mother often wrote to me of improvements in Macduff's life. He moved into a tiny apartment and he managed to buy a truck. He joined a church and married a widow with children. Almost the day after the wedding, Mother learned he began planting a garden in their yard and teaching his stepchildren the proper names of flowers. Mother felt a deep affection for Macduff. "We were a blessing to each other," she told me, "because I had so little to work with and yet was expected to make a park." And Macduff, though a man of few words, was devoted to Mother. Theirs was a friendship born of flowers and the gift of dignity. That's called The Man Who Lived in a Box, written by Marsha E. Brown, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the gardener's soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy, and we'll be talking with you soon.